Here are the quotations that I'm going to frame it with this morning. First, C.S. Lewis. There are two equal and opposite errors into which our race can fall about the devils. One is to disbelieve in their existence, and the other is to believe and then feel an excessive and unhealthy interest in them. Secondly, McLuhan. The current interest of youth in astrology, clairvoyance, and the occult is no coincidence. Mysticism is just tomorrow's science dreamed today. And R.D. Lang. This void may not be empty. It may be peopled by visions and voices, ghosts, strange shapes, and apparitions. And fourthly, Carl Jaspers. I got to know them after they'd already too much power. I now had the world of spirits I wanted to see, and the demons came up from the abyss. Fifthly, Rambo, the French poet. Spiritual warfare is just as brutal as human warfare. And lastly, the Apostle Paul. The kingdom of God is not a matter of talk, but of power. It should be apparent by now that it's a mistake to think of the counterculture as a monolithic unity. Certainly, it's compelling in its comprehensiveness. But as you look at the complexity, there are many contradictory elements. And it seems to roll on like a relentless river of amorphous people, trends, fashions, and ideals and aspirations. And at any one moment, there's no one fashion. And very often there are 100 eddies and cross currents and whirlpools. And it's very easy to be preoccupied with what's really, finally, inconsequential. But having looked at these psychedelics, we'll now go to see something that's been developing alongside them, and it's very much related to the failure of the psychedelics. And this is the last main trend we'll consider. A recent, but already a real defining feature of part of the movement. And it may in fact go far beyond the movement to be a profound influence in the closing years of our century. I'm speaking here of the resurgent trend in the occult. I think the best picture to see it is like this. The early hunters on safari in Africa used to build their fires high at night in order to keep away the animals in the bush. But when the fires burned low as the night went on, especially in the early hours of the morning, what would happen was that they'd see all around them the approaching shapes of animals, especially a ring of encircling eyes coming close in the darkness. When the fire was high, there were no animals, and they were far off. But when the fire burnt low, the encircling eyes approached again. As we've witnessed the erosion and breakdown of the Christian culture in the West, so we've seen the vacuum filled by an upsurge of ideas that would have been unthinkable when the fires of the Christian culture were high. But of them all, this last trend is perhaps the most sinister. It's far more than another compulsive spiral down which many have plunged. This trend, in a sense, is difficult to chart. Often the easiest place to chart is merely spectacular, silly, or sinister. And very often this is irrelevant to the deeper reality of the occult. And it's at this deeper reality that the cult really needs to be understood. So far as the future is concerned, at the moment only the grey outlines are emerging as to what might be. But I think these are already quite enough to quicken an appreciation of what you can really only describe as the horror of great darkness, which is sweeping over the West very slowly, almost rolling inwards like a swelling black tide, or looming larger in the darkness with its encircling eyes all round us. In many ways, this trend is the most surprising of them all in the counterculture. Only a short time back, any belief in such a world as the astral or the supernatural or the occult would have been relegated to the ridiculous. Such spine-tingling stories, like horror films, were dismissed as modern man's surrogates for his loss of belief in hell. They were anything but real. Perhaps stories of the occult were to be expected as part of the Middle Ages or the missionary world, but certainly they had little to do with the 20th century West, and still less to do with the avant-garde and our generation. But the occult today can no longer be relegated either in time to the Middle Ages or in distance to the so-called mission fields. And what we've seen is that some of yesterday's skeptics are now some of today's most firm believers. Yet despite this, and generally speaking, there is still, in most circles, a patronizing disregard, if not an outright disbelief, in any such talk. Probably it would still be virtually impossible to publish an article expressing belief in the reality of the occult world in any respectable journal of psychiatry, say in Britain or the States. Because these are still dominated, on the most part, by a naturalistic framework which rules these things out. People are speaking, though, of a long overdue anti-materialist liberation. And perhaps this is about to break. You can see in the books that have come out this year, a new respectability accorded to the occult which you haven't seen before, such as Arthur Koestler's book, Roots of Coincidence. This disdain is still found in most recent books. One of the British authorities on the occult, Pennethorne Hughes, writing as late as 1965, pronounced with complete finality that witchcraft, quote, is dying rapidly before the popular press, popular education, a national education, a national health scheme, and the American way of life. And he concluded his book on the witchcraft as a cult belief in Europe is dead. As a degenerate form of a primitive fertility belief, incorporating the earliest instructive wisdom, the practice is over. This is not untypical. And it's not really surprising, and even in much theology, where ostensibly one would expect to find a measure of belief, there's still little acknowledgement of the supernatural, either the positive or the negative. If you read the writings of men like Paul Tillich or Reinhold Niebuhr, they use the word demonic. But this is not actually to refer to an objective demonic world. Rather, they use the word demonic as a symbol of man's bias towards evil, which is irrational. In England, we had a man like Archbishop William Temple, who genuinely believed in a personal devil and was at the same time a profound scholar, as well as one of the leading archbishops in this century. But most people thought this was extremely strange and odd in so prestigious a leader. So what we've seen for a long, long time, and is still generally here, is this profound disdain. But what we see now is, in the West, and very much among our generation, we see this unmistakable resurgence in the belief and practice of the occult, ranging from the totally harmless, sometimes up to the really horrifying. For the sake of any of you who are listening, and this applies to those on tapes, because sometimes these get round to places far wider than the groups who come to Labrie, let me stress again those warning words of C.S. Lewis. There are two equal and opposite errors into which our race can fall about the devils. One is to disbelieve in their existence. The other is to believe and then feel an excessive and unhealthy interest in them. C.S. Lewis wrote his Screwtape Letters to a generation that was caught in unbelief by a mechanistic worldview and science which appeared to castrate and exorcise the supernatural or the unseen. And Lewis reminded them brilliantly of the subtlety and the very real reality of these things. Now imagine if Lewis was writing today, maybe he'd write a sequel to this book and write it in the opposite direction, warning people from the other danger. At the risk of blurring very real differences in the subject, and certainly this will be selective at certain points, I would like to examine the resurgence of the occult under three main categories where we can see this clearly. First, superstition. And secondly, spiritism. And thirdly, Satanism. Now, I stress that these categories and distinctions are obviously arbitrary in certain areas. Many of the different individuals into these things, or certain of the groups involved in the occult, have many widely differing impulses behind them, and so they're not always easy to categorize that simply. For example, some people are into these things just out of a jaded experience of life, and they're in it for the kicks. Some are very seriously pursuing the goals of higher psychic understanding. Some, on the other hand, have an almost antiquarian interest in the revival of pagan nature worship. Some have literally sold their souls to the devil, to the worst side of this. And many just demonstrate a weird amalgam of semi-beliefs and practices, just trying to involve themselves in an esoteric world in a totally eccentric way. And many, many people are in a whole range in between these things. Nevertheless, these three general categories are a bit arbitrary and selective, but I think they'll give a helpful outline. But before we look at these, let's ask, what are the factors behind this resurgence in the last decade? What are the factors behind this? Certain cultural factors are undoubtedly behind this swing. The first factor is the death of rationalism. The death of rationalism. Before and during the Reformation, witchcraft was persecuted relentlessly by the witch hunters. Their efforts, however, often served in the end to keep witchcraft alive. And really, witchcraft was killed in the end by the development and cultural adoption of the Reformation theology and later still by rationalism. The Reformation held that witches were real, but wrong. And in a sense, rationalism went deeper still and scorned them as non-existent, and therefore witchcraft was dismissed as meaningless. And it was the rise of rationalism in the 18th century that coincided with the general disappearance of witchcraft in Europe and the States. Witch hunts were eventually abolished in 1737. But now in the 20th century, when rationalism has really stumbled and its wings have been clipped both by psychoanalysis and modern philosophy, the door to the non-rational, the irrational, and the super-rational is very much wide open again. And one of the previous unthinkables, which would have been ruled out by rationalism, that has squeezed through the door, now we see the irrational, is the occult. A second factor is the skepticism towards the supernatural in most modern theology. Ever since the work of men like D.F. Strauss and Renan and the rise of higher criticism in theology, there's been a persistent infiltration from the secular premises of naturalistic philosophy. And one constant sign of this has been the removal of any lingering supernatural ideas. You can see this in the old quest for the historical Jesus and in the new quest for the historical Jesus. Both of them had to demythologize the Bible and remove and try to remove the supernatural. Of course, both of the quests founded on the fact that this is impossible. If you remove the supernatural Christ, you have no human Christ. So if you want a human Christ, you have to include the supernatural at some points. But the legacy of this sort of movement has been skepticism with two results. First, in a period when liberal theology appeared to speak for intelligent Christianity, it looked as if Christianity as a whole had succumbed to naturalism, which is only being disguised by semantic symbolism. So you said devil, angel, etc., but you didn't really believe they're objectively there, you're just using religious connotation words. Christianity no longer affirmed that the occult was real, but wrong. In other words, it lost its balanced position and joined the skeptics who denied it completely. This meant that for anyone searching for spiritual reality, they would not find it in the church, and they were forced back to areas outside the church and so to the occult. And you have a position today that, ironically, some of the last people to believe in these things are often liberal churchmen, because they've been lulled complacently to sleep by the smug rationalism of their theology. The second result of this liberalism has been that the critical control of biblical revelation has been lost. In the scriptures, you see that the occult is affirmed as real, but denied as illegitimate. And this gives the scriptures a critical norm by which the Christian can judge between true spirituality, which is genuine, and its counterfeit, which is illegitimate. But without these biblical norms as a critical control, the only norm you have is experience. So this loss of critical control explains why so many who once totally disbelieved have swung totally irrationally to an uncritical acceptance of all phenomena on the basis of experience only. Total disbelief and total acceptance are equally foolish, and the second is doubly dangerous. And this is the result of taking experience as normative. An example we'll see of this later on as we go on is Bishop Pike. The third factor is the influence of the Eastern religions. We've already noted the perverse fact that what people reject in Christianity, they often welcome with open arms from the East. It's evident in all the Eastern religions that however high the ethics, or however sophisticated the philosophy, at grassroots level there is open idolatry, animism, and spiritism. Whatever a Gautama Buddha may have said, or Muhammad may have said, the average Tibetan priest or the average Malaysian Bomo or witch doctor is a firm believer in the practice of the occult. And not surprisingly, belief in the occult often follows as an accepted part of the world view of those who have gone first into the Eastern religions. And this is especially true of those who have been fascinated with the various books of the dead, such as the Tibetan Book of the Dead. A fourth factor is the chaos and complexity of the modern culture. Just as anxiety is a symptom of existence in a bottleneck, so the upsurge of belief in the occult is symptomatic of a shortcut thinking motivated by the baffling complexity of modern life. If you look back to the time of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, superstition flourished freely among the various refugees from the crumbling religions which are failing. Today, many astrologers are recognizing that their popularity results partly from the failure of modern convictions, religious convictions, and also from the general uncertainty and the lack of alternative props in a culture like our own. The American astrologer says, "We're afraid to say no, no, no to the bearded man upstairs before we have a substitute." In other words, modern man is insecure in his crisis of identity and with his loss of center. And he finds the occult participation one answer. And this is why we have almost a psychic epidemic sweeping the post-Christian world. A fifth important factor is the present state of psychic and parapsychological research. Not so long ago, all transcendental experiences were denied as invalid, mistaken, deviant, or perhaps even mad. But today they're merely regarded as different, paranormal, or mystical. In England in 1882, the Society for Psychical Research was founded. And this was the first movement to get into these things scientifically. But as we've seen in some of the other lectures, it was actually the pioneer work of William James, which for many people opened the door to a serious appreciation of the occult. Back in 1903, James wrote in Varieties of Religious Experience, "In delusional insanity, we may have a diabolical mysticism, a sort of religious mysticism turned upside down." In other words, the world of insanity which you're looking at yesterday, not the world of insanity. James continues, "Only this time the emotion is pessimistic, the meanings are dreadful, and the powers are enemies to life. These spring from the same mental level, from that great subliminal or transmarginal region of which science is beginning to admit the existence, but of which so little is really known." That was 1903. Since then, the work of Dr. J.B. Ryan of Duke University on ESP and the theories of Carl Jung on synchronicity also point towards a similar end. And they suggest the paranormal state which closely parallels what was once held to be the astral plane of the occult. You know that synchronicity is the idea that everything in the universe at any given moment participates at that moment with everything else sharing that moment. Jung often used to refer to astrology as the intuitive science. And Jung actually used to cast horoscopes for his patients. He did this not to foretell the future of his patients, but rather because as they looked into the crystal ball of the horoscopes, he was able to unearth elements of his patients' personality as they looked into them. More recently in the area of psychology, R.D. Lang, writing of the present state of psychology, has said, "We may be back to a world long lost, and this void may not be empty. It may be peopled by visions and voices, ghosts, strange shapes and apparitions." And exploring the paranormal world further, R.D. Lang says, and particularly its relation of insanity to unsanity, as we were looking at yesterday, Lang says, "Madness need not be all breakdown. It may also be breakthrough." And in his usual inimitable style, McLuhan captures the present mood. "The current interest of youth in astrology, clairvoyance, and the occult is no coincidence. Mysticism is just tomorrow's science dreamed today." The sixth factor, and obviously this is one with relevance only to the Christian, or perhaps anyone who shares a similar worldview, is that for us, the supernatural world really does exist. Within the Christian framework, there is not so much a natural and a supernatural world, as if the natural were real and the supernatural were the less real. Rather, there's a seen and an unseen world, and both have equal reality. But we'll look at this more at the end. These six are just some of the factors which contribute to this movement towards the occult today. And this movement is part of a larger trend towards the perverse religiosity which is characteristic of our generation. This larger phenomenon, this religious trend, is a reaction to the failure of atheism. It exhibits what McLuhan describes as the reversal of the overheated medium. In other words, atheism, with its termini in mechanistic science, rationalistic philosophy, and technological objectivity, suddenly came to the end of the line and immediately rebounded into producing an entirely new and profoundly religious era. An era whose central hallmarks are the mystical and the subjective, and whose byproducts are the contentless, the counterfeit, and the confused. Now, I should have stressed this more in these last few lectures. Try and see this religious movement as a whole stream. You remember in the lecture on the Great Refusal, the history of the Beat movement and so on, the early Beats in the early days were their religious amalgam in a quaint way. Then the rise of the Eastern religions. Then the religious mysticism through the psychedelics yesterday. And now today we'll see the occult, and tomorrow we'll go on to see the Jesus movement. But all of these very much in a movement. Actually this afternoon, not tomorrow. So the recent Jesus movement is really only a later wave on following all these. The 60s was the decade marking the dramatic growth in the occult. If you want to take any date as the watershed, perhaps the best date would be 1966. Because this was the year in which the movement of the occult surfaced clearly into general popularity. This is the year in which several of the more famous Satan churches and magic circles and witches' covens were founded. Now, before we get into the story of the resurgence, two further points need to be added, just by way of a qualification. First, it's important to understand the various levels at which this subject could and should be studied on its own account if we had time. This chapter is emphatically not an apologetic for the devil or for the supernatural world. And I speak presupposing the reality of these things from both personal experience and strong convictions. As you know very well, those of you who have been here for any time at Labrie, we've seen coming through the community at Labrie many for whom this is far too real. So I'm not arguing in the slightest for the reality of the devil. Many of these people are curious dabbling and casual involvement has led them way out of their depth until tragically they're confronted a reality that's far beyond their control. But if there were time to treat the subject adequately in all possible levels, one would need to look at various areas, and you must have these at least in your mind. You'd have to look at the physical phenomena, the medical implications, psychological implications, the parapsychological implications, and the pastoral or counseling implications. And all of these are various levels on which one could look at it. I'd merely say this. Speaking as a Christian, I attempt always to try and avoid the two extremes. The first extreme is an over-skeptical rationalism, which just denies the whole thing. And the other extreme is a premature escape into the magical explanation of anything that one doesn't understand. Far too many people say, this is the devil, when really they're just depressed or things are against them and it's too busy. And they just escape too easily. I'm blaming them on the devil, which is really often their own faults. We must really avoid these two extremes. A good illustration of the necessary balance can be seen in the relation of herbalism to modern medicine. Moldy cheese was once applied as a cure for festering sores. Whether men believe this is supernatural magic or not, or whether it was merely a superstition, we now know that they were simply stumbling on a primitive application of penicillin. So anyone who said this is magic, would be very foolish today. Similarly, foxgloves were once used for heart ailments. But modern medicine has isolated the digitalis from the foxgloves and used this as a stimulant in heart drugs. Or again, Indians once used the raw wolfia root to cast out strange spirits. But now modern pharmacology uses some of the substances in this root in the manufacture of tranquilizers. This clearly underlines the necessity of examining every phenomena in the light of all the various implications and always avoiding the extreme interpretations of skepticism on the one hand or a magical superstition on the other hand. So there's one qualification. A second point is that these three main categories, superstition, spiritism, and Satanism, are arbitrary in one more sense, in the sense that they do not speak to the question of the reality of the phenomena or to the validity of the practice. These are later questions which need to be asked of any of these categories. Broadly speaking, all the phenomena we'll come across can be divided into two general classes, those which are hoax and those which are genuine. Now, the second category, though, of those which are genuine, in the sense that they succeed in some way that's objectively verifiable, there are three possible types of genuine success. First, just purely psychological power and knowledge. And secondly, supernatural influence in the cult. And thirdly, supernatural influence from God. Thus, in any of these three areas we're looking at, or any area in this, there are always four possible interpretations. First, that the thing is mere hoax. Second, that it's merely psychological. Third, that it's occult and demonic in its influence. And fourth, that it's supernatural from God and from the Holy Spirit. Sometimes the lines between these are not easy to draw. And the question of a really critical discernment is of prime importance, and we'll come to this as we go through. So let's begin with the first area, the area of superstition. This is the first general area where we can begin to see the resurgence in the increase of the occult, superstition. Superstitio is the Latin word meaning to stand still over. It describes man's dread of the baffling forces beyond his control, especially his fears and desires and hopes before a future that's quite unknown. Now, I'd stress that much of the evidence in this area is casual to the point of being inconsequential and hardly worth our looking at. But it does at least indicate a deeper groundswell. And at its more serious level, it takes on political and personal, even criminal, implications at some points. The origins of astrology are lost in the dim mists of antiquity. Certainly by 3000 BC, the Chaldeans and the Babylonians had developed an astrological system of immense sophistication. Probably the Tower of Babel was such an astrological tower, a ziggurat, used for their forecasting. The whole thing centered around the construction of such ziggurats as the Tower of Babel and was structured on a priestly class so that their astrology had two basic premises. One was that they believed in the determined conformity of the macrocosm or the universe to the microcosm, man. The other was the belief in the identification of stars with active deities. Out of this spread this immensely sophisticated system. From the Middle East, astrology spread further east to India and China, south to Egypt and west to Rome, and finally across to Europe. And it's important to recognize how pervasive and all-embracing its influence was. It wasn't just the common people who took to astrology and superstition, but it was prevalent and commonly practiced in the highest circles of court and politics. There was a Greek poet who said, "Horoscopes cost one drachma, and are one drachma too expensive." But skepticism like that was extremely rare, and such skeptics were the odd men out. And we're apt to forget today how recent widespread skepticism is. This skepticism against astrology grew first from the powerful scorn of the church in the West. Where astrology still flourished, it was closely allied to Roman Catholic corruption at its worst. Augustine called astrology the most stupid delusion of mankind and said, "This dog is chained." And Savonarola strongly attacked it in Florence. Martin Luther described it as a shabby art. And this is typical of the way that there was a mounting skepticism and disapproval of it. But despite this, it's strange to remember that even a reformer, a friend of Martin Luther's, like Philip Melanchthon, he held the chair of astrology as well as theology. And even so celebrated a modern scientist as Johannes Kepler also held the chair of astrology as well as being a modern scientist. When we ignore how short-lived historical disbelief really is, we tend to smile in a rather superior way at all the superstition we see. So, for instance, if I refer to various areas of superstition, you probably smile in a rather superior way. For example, the Burmese who refuse to wash their hair on holy days. Or Zambians who think that the eating of eggs cause sterility. Or Chinese travelers who never turn their fish on a plate, lest the ship they're on also capsizes. Or African tribes who don't boil milk over fires for fear that the cow too will suffer. These, we tend to smile at such things, such benighted ignorance. Isn't this the twilight zone of the people who are merely undereducated and overanxious? Yet extraordinarily, the first evidence of today's occult is in this area. A resurgence that's been prophesied by astrologers and recognized by both psychologists and sociologists. And taken up, seriously and semi-seriously, by the most scientifically sophisticated generation of young adults in the whole of history. You know the astrologers are saying that after 2,000 years of Pisces, the era of disillusionment and skepticism following the death of Christ, we're now entering the age of Aquarius, the age of faith and aspirations, in which astrology comes into its own. You remember the well-known lines from Hare. The hallmark, though, of this new superstition is its hedging of the bets. And this is the thing to listen for as you hear people who are superstition. Nothing is really believed totally. Each superstition is characterized by a half acceptance and a half denial, which gives superstitious modern man the best of both worlds. You often hear these people who do the touch wood, for instance, or whatever. They do it very rigorously and religiously, as if they believed it. But then they laugh at themselves, even if they do it, as if they don't believe it. And you see the half acceptance, half denial in the same thing. There's two areas in which sociologists say we're seeing this. The first is the resurgence of the old superstitions. Many of these, of course, have become ritual reactions whose meaning has been lost and no longer explicitly relates to magic and spiritism, but these are evidently said to be on the rise. Touch wood, or knock on wood, as I think you call it in the States, was probably originally related to belief in a primeval forest god. Not to walk under a ladder indicated respect for the Egyptian sacred numerology, in which the mystical three was the sacred triangle made by the ladder leaning against a wall. This should never be broken, and if broken was bad luck. Similarly, throwing salt over one's shoulder was thought to bring good luck because it was cast in the face of the evil spirit who walked behind the left shoulder. It's very interesting, isn't it? The left is always considered bad and right good. So in most languages, the word left has negative connotations. The Latin is the word sinister. The French is the word gauche, awkward. Both of them have the negative connotations for the word left. As you'll see later on, witchcraft historically is called the left-hand game. So the evil spirit was considered over the left shoulder. Sneezing was always followed by a blessing, God bless you, or salute, or gesundheit, because the sneezer was thought to have made himself vulnerable as he sneezed to the evil spirits who get in after the vacuum created by his sneeze. Now these, of course, which once had magical primitive connotations, definitions rather, now only have lingering connotations and are really ritualized reactions that are almost instinctive and subconscious. But the increase in superstition by a growing number of people is reflected in a semi-denial and semi-belief, even according to these. And as I say, you listen to people who knock on wood and so on, and they do it very seriously with the act, and then they laugh at themselves at the same time. Their scrupulous persistence in practicing them points to some sort of belief, while their self-deprecating mockery in which they're practiced is the counterbalance in denial, so they get the best of both worlds. They're very modern, and yet they're superstitious. On the other hand, there's a mounting number of new superstitions that sociologists point to. In this category, some people point to the belief in flying saucers, or the notion that H-bomb tests cause rain, or that test bans cause drought. And I don't know whether the truth in some of these. But the point to notice generally is that it's intriguing that many of these newer superstitions, some of the old ones too, are to be observed among the scientifically and technologically sophisticated. Time magazine, a long while back, reported that many airline pilots in the transatlantic run spit on their wheels regularly before every flight in their pre-flight inspection. You know that originally saliva was an offering to the gods. Now, certainly they're not doing that, but they do it very religiously. Certain of the European Grand Prix racing drivers will refuse to drive if a single peanut is found in their pits. And it's interesting that many computer experts, faced with the intelligence and complexity, almost personality of their machines, are tending to anthropomorphize them in a way that's really superstitious. The manager at a research corporation near Boston was quoting it as saying, "I hire everyone building my computer by the zodiac sign under which they were born. My computer is Leo and prejudiced. I happened to hire two cancer men and they both ended up with ulcers." It's interesting that you see these things not just among the primitive people today, but among some who are really very sophisticated intellectually, scientifically, and technologically. Now, I stress that most of this is casual and very non-inconsequential. And this form of superstition is not a general feature of the counterculture as a whole. But talking of the boom of astrology, the story comes home nearer to the counterculture. Perhaps at the moment, this boom in astrology is the most spectacular indication of a recent interest in the cult. In 69, Time estimated there were 10,000 full-time astrologers in the States. And the evidence of this boom is too obvious to need recounting. The rash of horoscopes, computerized or not, in magazines and newspapers. The vogue for hostesses casting I Ching for dinner dates and sending out invitations on astronotes. And the whole way all the commercial corporations have jumped on the bandwagon of astrology in their advertising. The smorgasbord of astrology courses at the various free universities. the astrological credits in pop records, and the respectability of leading seers like Carol Reiter and Gene Dixon and Maurice Woodruff and Arthur Ford. In other words, the whole question of a man's individual significance is being overshadowed with uncertainty. And today, more and more, this is the sad thing, the process of decision-making and the exercise of significance is being relegated to this zone of astrology and cartomancy and palmistry and crystal gazing and the Ouija board. Maybe the Ouija board is particularly important in this, because on the one hand, it's just a game and trivial. But for many, it has been the doorway to a much more serious occult involvement. You know, the word Ouija comes from the French and the German words for yes combined, oui and ja. And thousands of these boards are sold commercially, and most of them are used totally harmlessly as a game. But with a small percentage, the game has backfired, and several have found themselves out of their depth as a spirit has genuinely taken control of the board. And I know quite a group for whom this experience has been their initiation into the continued practice of contacting spirits and developing eventually mediumistic powers. Thus, in a sense, the Ouija board is typical, because although most would merely laugh at such a suggestion, those who have seen it work and have got into the deeper things really appreciate the reality of the supernatural realm. Now, this first area, superstition, provides a good example of the necessity for critical discernment. Obviously, in this area, nothing here in any way comes from God. And we can divide the phenomena here into three basic types. The first type, and by far the largest of the categories, includes all the evidence which can be described only as fraud and hoax and swindle. This is the greater part of those superstitions which cash in on the credulity of modern man. Fraud, hoax, and swindle. Maybe 95% of modern astrology is of this type. And this is what's reflected in the vogue and merchandising and show business, etc. Many, many examples of this I could give you. Incidentally, since I'm taping the lecture this time, I'm not using any examples of my own personally. At least I give an example that I myself know that happened to me, but I won't mention things that happened to people I've known coming through here. Instead, in place, I'll just take examples that are already written in books, and specifically by Kurt Koch. Kurt Koch tells the story of a student in Paris who did his research thesis on the psychology of superstition. So he placed an ad in a newspaper as an astrologer and promised detailed horoscopes for everyone who'd pay just 20 French francs. What he did was to cast one horoscope for all 400 clients who wrote in. He had no idea at all, complete disregard of the zodiac signs, but he found that if you included enough positive encouragement and supportive ideas, balanced by negative warnings in a vague sort of way, in other words, based on the psychological understanding of the influence of fear and wishful thinking, all his horoscopes, i.e. one for them all, were greatly appreciated. And through these horoscopes, he financed his studies and gained an honors degree at the Sorbonne. The whole thing was total hoax. Koch tells another story of a conference in Germany, where a newspaper editor told how one weekend a horoscope hadn't arrived to be included in the Sunday paper. So he just inserted an old one. Totally incorrect, because he hadn't a clue what the zodiac signs were. Despite the wide circulation of his paper to hundreds of thousands of readers, no one noticed the error. Saving his astrologer's fees, he repeated this deception a large number of times and concluded, during the time of the incorrect horoscope, everything went quite well. Clearly, it did not depend on the horoscope, but on what people believed. It's true that modern astrology, as it's practiced by most people with their schemes, has no scientific basis, and its fraudulence becomes successful not because of what people read, but because of what they read into their horoscopes. At best, such astrology is only a kind of constructive counseling, always with a classic ambiguity like the Oracle at Delphi. The widely, for example, you could look at the predictions astrologers have, all pointing to the same event. And you see that for everyone which is correct, many more are wrong. You could take as an example the assassination of Kennedy. Gene Dixon is remembered for prophesying the assassination correctly. All those at the same time, and many more were, who were prophesying his re-election, his divorce, and many, many other events contingent on his living, are completely forgotten. It's exactly because this category covers the greater part of modern astrology and superstition that many believe all of it to be fraud and swindle, successful only with a strong degree of rationalization or sheer luck, but this is not so. So here's this first category, sheer fraud. And we as Christians should be the first, we should be as skeptical as the atheist in mocking it and laughing it out of court and being quite above and beyond the folly of this ridiculous stuff. Two other categories deserve more serious attention, however. The second one is that group of powers which do succeed, but only because of the natural powers of telepathy or suggestion. Neither psychological knowledge nor psychological power are supernatural. Both are entirely naturalistic. But they can succeed in a certain way. And sometimes this can be sinister. Koch gives an example of this. There was a girl who once met a gypsy woman who was trying to sell her household goods at the front door. She was looking after the house for her friends. When she refused to buy the goods, the gypsy snatched her hand and said, "Oh, that's interesting. You're going to marry within 2 years." You can imagine the girl was naturally intrigued, and she left her hand then. The gypsy went on. "Several men are going to ask you to marry them, but you'll marry the tallest one." "Oh, and in the first year of your marriage, yes, you'll become a mother. And then the line stops quite suddenly, and then you'll die during the birth of your first child." She just dropped her hand and hurried off. And exactly as prophesied, the girl, who was evidently highly marriageable anyway, in other words, you could have guessed it, was married, but before the birth of her first child, a complete and paralyzing fear gripped her totally and just crept over every area of her life. A fear which no psychologist's analysis or any assurance from her husband was able to calm. And the child was eventually born, and the birth itself was uncomplicated. But then a fever broke out for no apparent organic reason. The girl became mentally deranged and died 3 weeks later. And doctors were forced to conclude that she'd been subject to thanatomania, or the death wish. In several countries, the fear of the spirits, or curses, or witch doctors and voodoo, probably relates to this. I'm not saying that a genuine occult power isn't sometimes used, it is. But often the subject of the curse, the object of the curse, rather, of magic, succumbs to a total paralysis of life because of absolute fear. Now, much of the evidence in the second category is not like this, sinister or criminal. But the point I'm making is that even when it is as serious as this story, it need not imply in any sense more than the power of telepathy or suggestion. But there is a third category which would include those powers or prophecies which do succeed, but only because of a genuine occult influence. And there are many examples of this today in the area of healing or fortune telling. In other words, healing and fortune telling are successful in the sense that the cure is made or the prophecy comes true. But that's not the end of the matter. The successful conclusion is usually accompanied by one of two things. Either a hardening against spiritual things and a loss of peace, or what comes later and is often called the devil's compensation or the devil's bargain. In other words, following such a mediumistic healing, there may come severe depressions and spiritual heaviness and an obsession or a strong addiction to something like alcohol or cigarettes, some instability or a terror of people or whatever. And again, I know several people, and I won't give you personal examples, who've been into mediumistic healing or something like this, and then have had the most extraordinary and bizarre things which no doctor or psychologist was later able to explain, but which you can really put down to the devil's compensation, and which, once they're freed from these things, just goes like that. Among several biblical examples, Paul's exorcism of the divining girl at Philippi is a good one. The girl whose mediumistic powers are being exploited commercially, and this could be given many modern parallels. Now, if most of the current phenomena can be put into one of these three categories, it should be obvious that the fraudulent is really superficial, the psychological possibly more serious, only the mediumistic is in any way sinister. But it should also make it clear that experience alone can never be normative. We also need a real understanding of the source and the nature of the experience. The last category, that of genuine occult power, should really come more properly under spiritism or Satanism and not under superstition. But the lines between the categories are here a little rather more blurred. But this section on superstition is important primarily for showing the first hints of what's coming and for indicating the credulity and uncertainty of modern man in the area of rational consideration and decision making. Is it really a compliment to Western man and his view of himself that he has to lean heavily on the fragile crutch of astrology? Nor is it any cause for confidence when Western leaders and public figures are swayed by mediums and metaphysicians, genuine or bogus. I really think the resort to superstition is part of the shadow of night that just seems to be falling across our culture. It's extraordinary. I know people who know high up people in many circles in New York, not so much political circles, but circles in advertising, publishing, design, and so on. Amazing how many of them weekly resort to the New York metaphysicians as a way of life. Leading people whose names we know, whom we'd respect in their fields, all of them going to these people. The second general area is spiritism. Now let's look at this next. A large part of this involves the increasing belief in animism and the practice of witchcraft. The word witch comes from the Middle English word Wicca, W-I-C-C-A, which means wise. And it's also related to the root of the word wicked and wick, meaning a lie. Witchcraft is the old religion, the cult of Wicca, what they call the power or the craft or the left-hand game. And those in this say that it's the true religion of Europe, which was usurped by Christianity but is now surfacing again. Very probably, three sources contribute to witchcraft as we now know it. The first is the ancient fertility cult beliefs that were native in Europe prior to Christianity and common around the world in most pagan nature worship areas. The second element is the heritage of the magic and the magical practices derived from Egypt and the priests in Egypt. And the third element is the series of parodies directed at the major religions contemporary with the various phases of witchcraft. Witchcraft always saw itself as a kind of anti-religion. So part of what it always sought to do was to parody and mock and caricature the particular religion which was dominant in its own day, and a whole series of different parodies arose. Of course, this made the witchcraft very controversial. And it's for reasons like this that the objective facts of its history are totally beyond our discovery. For instance, the records of witch hunts come only from the witch hunters. And few witch hunters were known for their impartial and unbiased objectivity. And their methods of identifying witches were completely arbitrary and usually totally monstrous. For example, if you found a wart on a woman, it was taken to be a third nipple and a sure sign that the woman was a witch. So it's not surprising that our evidence is poor and their persecutions were barbarous. The Roman Catholic Dominicans, the Dominican monks, saw themselves as the Domini Canes, which is the hounds of the Lord. And the Middle Ages witnessed a ghastly series of burnings, hangings, and drownings. There was one time in Strasbourg alone in France, in just one 20-year period, when over 5,000 women were reckoned to have been burnt, and entire villages were wiped out because of the accusation of witchcraft. And the echoes of many notorious stories still ring down to our own time. So because of this, the interpretations of what witchcraft really is are radically split. And there are several interpretations. I'll just throw out some of the strands. One would be the Orthodox Roman Catholic view. The best representative of this in our century is a man called Dr. Montague Summers. Their idea is that witchcraft is the work of the Antichrist. Since witches were in league with the devil himself against Christendom, any persecution could be justified if it rooted out this vile heresy from the Antichrist. As we look back, this is probably a grossly simplistic view of the original situation. And in no way does it justify the monstrous ecclesiastical violence which is used against the witches. The second and opposite view is that witchcraft was entirely an invention of its enemies. This is the view of the rationalist.